Oh, go Hornets.
Really? Right on. All right, thank you. Well, I don't have to stand there. Thank you, and it's been a long time since I've been down to Spats, and I need to come down more. And this is my first EBP presentation, so bear with me. Hopefully I don't bore the heck out of you guys today. I'm going to try to do a little bit different kind of approach than most of the EBP sessions that I've been to. A little bit more of a practical sense. In the introduction, I tried to make sure that you guys have an idea of my background, that I do still practice clinically, even though I've gone to the dark side and I'm an educator and I sit and have this relationship with my computer and forms and that kind of stuff. I still get out into the athletic training clinic and I work with patients and I try to be active. So I understand that day-to-day, grind that comes along with the athletic training world. A couple things as well. If you've been exposed to patient reported outcome measures, there's a lot of foundational stuff that I have to go over. I mean, that's what if you look on the schedule, it's a foundational session. So there's a lot of foundational stuff that we need to get through. And I apologize if you've been exposed to that before. I'll try to get through as quick as I can. I do want to, like I said, I want to get to the practical side of things as well. You can see my objectives. I'm not a big reader off the slide. So, if you're interested in what's on, read it and then we'll go from there. So I think we'll start with the classic EBP diagram, right? It's like, oh, not this again. We already, every time we have to start with this, is this like a rule that we have to do? But I mean, ultimately, athletic training, we're a health allied health profession. We want to be seen as an allied health profession. We want to be, in the conversation of medical providers and be respected, and we have an opinion. But to do that, we have to act like a healthcare provider. We have to act like another allied health profession. And when you look at allied health professions, we got, there's a number of recommendations and requirements of evidence-based medicine and evidence-based practice that we're doing. Hold on. So I start here really quick. I'll go through this from the clinical expertise part. Love it or hate it, whatever you think about the educational transition that's happening, all the changes in education is to create that clinical expert. You guys are sitting here in a conference and going to workshops and learning things and trying to become and expand your skills and become experts and hopefully taking some of this stuff back to your clinical practice. And hopefully, when you take that stuff back, you see, does this stuff work for you? You do some practice-based research, or you get some of that practice-based evidence that, man, this stuff works for me. I do cold, for cold water immersion for recovery. Well, evidence says it doesn't work, but man, for me, my patients do well. And that's the cool stuff about the clinical expertise is that we're in charge of that, and we can look at what we do in our clinic and how and what works for us, and take some of these outcome measures and. Establish that, no, this is work. Maybe there's not a lot of evidence for ice. We heard that yesterday, and it's kind of depressing because that's all we do sometimes. But look, if you collect some of these outcomes and you can, establish some of your own clinical expertise, that's the cool part for me. I know I'm getting, hopefully I don't get off on too many tangents here, but I'm getting a little bit excited. I'll move on. From the evidence side of things, it's frustrating. I mean, it's frustrating if you want to try to get something in the journal or any journal, really. It's frustrating because it takes so long. It's frustrating because so much goes in. You take one problem in athletic training, one problem, and it takes so much. There's so much little pieces that goes into that that has to be kind of parsed out and studied and looked at, and then you start putting them together, and then you start doing reviews, and then you start, you start doing the randomized controlled trials, and you finally get down to the reviews and clinical trials, and you finally get to a point that you have some kind of a guideline. Hey, maybe we should be doing some neuromuscular training, all right? But it takes so long, and so it's frustrating. I felt the pain or that it was very similar to me when Mark Merrick talked about the conclusions. How many times, if you read an article, or if you read a randomized controlled trial, how many times do you see at the conclusion, not enough evidence, may help? It's frustrating. So I get that, and that's why sometimes the evidence part, it's a struggle. The last part of this, though, is where I think, or I see, athletic training really struggling, is the patient, grabbing that patient value, and that patient expectation and beliefs. And I think if you think back in your clinical practice of all the different patients you have all kinds of different patients, and you probably have the one that, like, man, if everybody could be like this person. And then you have the ones that just frustrate you, and you're like, you see somebody coming, and you're like, I don't want to deal with it. And they trap you, and you're stuck. There's all kinds of different things that we have to get to grasp. The patient perception and that whole person care is another recommendation from Institute of Medicine, World Health Organization, American Medical, all these alphabet soup groups that we're supposed to be. If we're a healthcare profession, if we're an allied health provider, we need to be doing some of this patient-centered care. So to do that, I think with this, that patient-centered care and that perception part just brings us into this concept of the disablement model. This is the, you know, this is a wider view of it. If you have access to the online handouts, this is on there. I think this is a great diagram to kind of look at it and get kind of that idea. I'll go through it real quick. I could probably go for a long time on disablement, but just real quick, we'll go through it. But really what a disablement model does, it just is a way of looking at an injury and looking at the person as a whole person and kind of getting all their expectations, their beliefs, and what they're expecting out of their experience, out of their injury experience. And what you can expect as a clinician. So to go through it real quick, to give you a quick analogy or a quick example, a patient comes up in the middle of a game and says, "Man, my shoulder's hurting. I don't have the power. I can't push off. I'm an offensive lineman. I don't have any power to push off." So we start going through our evaluation, and you say, "All right, well, how long has this been bothering you?" And the response is, "Well, you know, it's been, you know, about a month now. I've just been dealing with it." And that's where I get that question. Well, the obvious question is, well, where have you been, right? You know where I am every day of my life for like 12 hours a day. Why don't you come see me, all right? The answer is within this disablement model, all right? So as we go through, we start doing our evaluation. It's the middle of a game. I'm not going to chastise this person right now. I'll save that for later, but I will. So we go through the evaluation. You go, man, your supraspinatus tendon is just super inflamed. You probably, you know, it's been happening for a month. You've had previous injuries. You probably have some tendinopathy going on. And so when we get to the actual first part, that impairment part, this is where we excel. Athletic trainers, we know our anatomy. We know our healing process and our physiology. We know the mechanics. This is what we do. Right, so this is our wheelhouse. We're very good at the impairment stuff. So we know exactly what goes into a tendon injury in the shoulder and what that's going to do. We're very good at the second part as well. We can identify what's normal, what's abnormal. Right? We can go, look, you have poor strength. You have a poor range of motion. No wonder you can't push off. So this is where we excel in this disablement part. When we get to the functional part, functionally, we start to you know, we can still see something. We can see an athlete that can't run or can't do a certain activity. We can see some of this thing. If this offensive lineman is getting pancaked every time, we can see that, all right? But now is where we also have to start relying a little bit on them, all right? If this is what I see right here, if, you know, in the midst of a football game, if I'm watching my offensive lineman who told me his shoulder hurts, and I'm seeing him block, and you know, he blocks, and the running back runs right by him, I'm going, okay, he blocked, all right? What I don't see is what he's perceiving is, I don't have the power to push off. I'm used to pushing that guy and putting him on his butt. I can't do that, all right? So this is where we start to rely on what they're telling us. Another example, have you ever had the person say a lower extremity injury, like a knee injury, and they'll say, yeah, it feels okay, but I just can't cut. I mean, it feels like whenever I go to cut, it just feels weird. What do I do with weird? What do I do with that? You know, it just feels like I can't, or it feels like it's loose, or it feels like this. And you know, those are the things that we start to get their information and their perception of what's going on. And so once they, and then there's a big range of this functional limitation. And so Then we get into the, as that functional limitation progresses, then we start to get into that, the fact of the disablement, all right? And this is why they don't come in earlier, because they're able to do what their responsibilities and what they want to do. They're able to continue, and so even if he doesn't have the power to push off, if he can still block, he's going to keep playing, you know? And so it really comes down to what the expectation that patient has and what their responsibilities are. We can take this to a non-athletic example. You know, if we're talking about somebody who goes to work every day, you know, and they have a shoulder pain, they're starting to struggle with it. If they can continue to do their and perform, they're probably going to continue to do that until they get to a point where the functional limitations become overwhelming and they can't do something. A lot of times, people will just adapt and they'll find a different way. But that's what the, you know, when you get to that disability part is, all right, now I can't do something. And then how that relates or how that affects that whole person, and here's where we get to that whole person care, patient-centered care, how that, the fact that I can't be an offensive lineman, I lose my starting job, the way that affects that person as a whole. When you talk about a football player who all they do is play football, and all they've done since this stall is play football, and now we've taken that away for an extended period of time, that has a pretty big effect, right? If that's who they see themselves as, yes, that has a big effect. It could have, you know, we can be talking about other, you know, from societal stuff. It's really, what responsibilities do I have? Does this person have a job that they have to fulfill? Does this person, you know, if we're talking about a high school kid, does this person have chores or something around the house or the ranch that he has to help dad with? And now, because of this shoulder issue, that's taken away, and that puts some significant mental strain on that person. And so now we start to affect some of that other stuff. And so that's where the disability concept just kind of gets to the point of, all right, what is the difference between what I can do and what I need to do, what I want to do, what my responsibilities are, and where is that level? If it becomes to the point where I cannot do that, then it starts to affect the person. And so that's a lot of times why people don't come in. I mean, think of your own aches and pains and bruises. Right? Athletic trainers make the worst patients sometimes. And we can say that of a lot of medical professions. We know, hey, yeah, I know what I should do, but do we do it? Some of us do, some of us don't, because it's not a priority. Right? It's not that priority right now. Yeah, I got a little soreness. I'll deal with that later. And you kind of keep going. So I start, you know, this is a good time to kind of ask the question. If I ask this question right now, I'm guessing I would get an overwhelming response. But do you think you have a positive impact in your patients' lives? When there's an injury, right? When there's an injury and you go and intervene and you do all your treatment, care, rehab, whatever you do, are they better off because you help them? Because I promise you, I mean, we're all thinking, well, yeah, of course, I've seen it. But I promise you, that person's going to heal no matter what we do. Now, do we, you know, our intent is to intervene and make their lives better, get them back better and more quickly than they would without us. But how do we know? How do we know that our interventions help? And that's what I talk about now, is I go into this evidence part. How do we know? The first part that we do, and all of you, if you're not asleep right now, if you're into it and you heard that question, you're thinking, well, yeah, I know, because I see swelling, and then it goes away, and I see range of motion deficits, and then it gets better, right? So the clinical or the disease-oriented evidence is easy. Again, this is about the impairment. This is our wheelhouse. This is what we do. How many times have we seen a sprained ankle, seen the motion deficits, the strength deficits? You got a 2 out of 5 7 days ago, and today you're at 5 out of 5. I did that. Look at me. You know, so we have some good evidence that we can look at. What we may not do a good job is getting the evidence from the patient. Now we ask, hey, how's it feel today? You know, how's this, how's that? But getting some of their perspective and some of that information of, yeah, I'm walking normal, but when I'm going upstairs, it just doesn't feel right. Or the random comments that's going on. When we start, like, it's easy with the, oh, let me go back. I wanted the laser. When we, no laser. when we have that symptom improvement, and you can, you know, that's the easy part. But then the other part is that health-related quality of life, that wide-angle view of health that we can take a look at and look at the whole person and really how this injury and this event is affecting their overall wellness, because it's more than just the physical wellness that we'll deal with. When we look at the simple things like, and I did this for a long, I do this for a long time. And I still do. I ask in an evaluation, I ask, you know, how are you sleeping? You know, the injury happened yesterday, and they're in the clinic today, and I'm doing an evaluation or a reevaluation. I'll say, how'd you sleep last night? Were you able to sleep through the night? Originally, my intent was just to get an idea of how bad it hurts, right? So, you know, can they get into a spot of rest and then sleep? And that kind of gives me, you know, I use that as a measure of how bad this thing is really bothering them. But what about if they tell you, man, it was hurting me, it was killing me all night. I slept for like 3 hours and then I was tossing and turning. I couldn't find a comfortable, every time I moved, it hurt, right? So yeah, the pain part you get, but you also get the part that this person slept 3 hours, right? They did not get enough sleep. Do you think sleep is important for healing? Well, yeah. You know, and so we're getting some ideas here. We're getting some a bigger view of what's going on. Does this person, you know, have to drive? You know, if this is an ankle injury, does this person have to drive? Well, I have to go pick up my brother and you know, I have siblings that I have to take around and chauffeur around. I have to do that. Mom's at work, right? And so how that ankle injury affects the person, it's a big deal, right? Going up and down stairs. You know, you may get to a point after that 7 days of an ankle sprain, and you saw all the swelling, and the edema's gone, and your motion's back, and you got good strength, and you're doing, and you're feeling really good. And then that person gets home, and they can't get up the stairs without pain, or they have to sit there and use that rail and kind of get themselves up. They don't feel like they're better. You feel like they're better. You feel like, man, this person's a lot better. I'm doing a dang good job. Pat myself on the back, but that person gets home and they go, man, my ankle. I am still dealing with that ankle. And they still have that. And that's that disability part. How much of that person's life is affected by the disablement? Because really they don't, like I said, they don't feel like they're getting as better, not as much as we feel like they're getting better. From a patient or from the health-related quality of life, again, that just, you know, I just wanted to reiterate the different personal beliefs and expectations. How many people have patients right now that have an amazing pain tolerance? And then the other side, they have no pain tolerance. You know, you ask them, hey, you know, scale of 1 to 10, give me your pain. Oh, it's a 9.5. And you're like, I saw you take off your jacket. 9.5s don't just take off their jacket, right? So it's not a 9.5. And now let me tell you what a 9.5 actually is. And you come up with some kind of, you know, I always, since I, you know, not female, I can't use childbirth, but I had to try to come up with some kind of descriptor of 9.5 is bad, dude. But there's, you know, their history of interacting with pain and injury pulls into that. And you see that with kids all the time. What happens when the little child falls down and they're like that moment of, what just happened, right? If there's that, you know, whatever that response was, and a lot of us are like, get up, come on, you're not hurt, let's go, go, go. Because you don't want them to realize that this is not a, you know, we want them to kind of associate that this is not a big deal. It depends on what that person's experience is on how they're going to react to the injury. Sometimes the opposite side with the people that have the too high pain tolerance, and they just keep going. You know, you gotta stop. Because you're damaging, and they're like, no, I'm good, right? So there's a lot of things. The other things on expectations and experiences, how many times have we, you know, if you think about your patient experiences, and you go, the person that doesn't want to go to the doctor no matter what, you know, I don't do doctors, no doctors, not for me, and that's just, you know, personally, there, you know, it may be seen as a weakness in the family if you go to the doctor. Anybody had the parent that does that? He's soft. We're not going. He's going to be fine. And they'll kind of, you know, just brush that off. And you're like, no, you probably need to go get an X-ray. No. I mean, they'll be fine. other extreme is you tell somebody, you counsel, you probably spend way too much time doing this too. You counsel somebody that you have a strained muscle. Your hamstring is strained, okay? Go home, I see you give them all this kind of, and what do? Do I need to go to the hospital? No, please don't go to the hospital. You don't need to go to the doctor. We don't need to do anything. You just need to rest and do, you know, these care principles that I've given you. And what happens? They come back the next day, went to the hospital, right? Yeah, I was hurting, and my mom just, you know, she just took me to the hospital. Great. What'd they tell you? They said I strained my hamstring. Yeah, that's what I said, right? And you know, you guys are all laughing because this is like the, you know, the common experience that goes on. But we have to realize that, you know, patients are coming from all different backgrounds and expectations, and that all feeds into what they do. Not that it doesn't mean it's frustrating. You know, not that I'm saying, yeah, don't be frustrated. Just, you know, realize it. No, it's still frustrating, but we can also just get an idea of every person's expectation is different, and their engagement in what we want them to do, obviously, is going to be different, and how can we affect that? So a couple things on the health-related quality of life. I'll throw up a couple of literature stuff. The first one was done in collegiate soccer players in the off-season, in their conditioning, in their non-traditional season. And really the highlights here is that sport participation does not negatively affect health-related quality of life. You know, and you're thinking, okay, well, that makes sense. The better one that I saw or that I took away from that was that those who did have decreases and changes in their health-related quality of life, it was related to other outside factors, the personal, the societal, injury situations. And so there's, you know, basically that athletes are affected by, you know, outside stuff. Huh, really? That's surprising. But we need to research. We need some evidence to do that. The second one is, and there's a lot of, you know, I could probably sit up here for the whole time, you know, throwing up articles and explaining each one. The second one is the health-related quality of life in a specific injury, specifically in chronic ankle instability patients. And so, not surprisingly, if somebody has a chronic unstable ankle, they don't have a good quality of life. Now, this is a population that is participating in their sport, right? So, as athletic trainers, we've become very good at getting people on the field. I can get that person back, and sometimes I think we you know, that's our main focus, and we lose sight of the person. But man, I can give you a stable ankle. Trust me. I can brace and tape, and I can do all kinds of stuff. I'll give you a stable ankle so you can go out and perform. But their health-related quality of life, when they go home, suffers. And so they have there is some significant changes in their overall quality of life. The other cool part, and so it's like the second one is always the better one. The second one there is, to me, the better one, is that when you look at healthy population, health-related quality of life, and just people that are coping with an ankle sprain. Grade one, grade two, I'm getting better, I'm going through it, coping with that ankle sprain. No change. All right, so that tells me that a simple injury and recovery process, not a huge deal. We don't have to throw up lights and sirens and get them to the psychiatrist and do a bunch of crazy stuff. We have a window here, you know, and so there's some interesting things about that. So when we get to that, you know, we talked about the evidence, and I've talked about that practice-based research, getting your evidence to guide your practice, and how do we do that? We collect our outcomes, and we measure what we do. Again, clinician-rated outcomes, this is what we do. This is our wheelhouse. We look at these things. This is what we've been trained to do. This is what we're very good at. And the misperception sometimes that we take, and it's easy to fall into this, as a clinician, we are focused on the physiology. When we see physiology getting better, when we see this person is now balancing, this person is back to within 10% of their preseason vertical jump, okay, we see that and we go, man, that's success. The physiology, you know, we're basically repair, we're you know, people repair person, you know, that's what we do. And so we get excited about that. That's the stuff that we measure. Hopefully, and I mentioned earlier about this clinical expertise, hopefully you guys do that in some form. Because you measure, you see something at a conference, you go, man, I'm going to start doing that. And then you measure how it works. And if it works good for your practice, you kind of keep going. If it doesn't work and takes too much time or it's too expensive, then you don't. And that's that practice-based evidence. And trying to collect that a little bit more on a formal level is important. It's important to be that evidence-based clinician that we want. The biggest thing, though, and I mentioned this with the stairs, I've mentioned this a couple times, and I've alluded to this, the problem with focusing on just the physiology part is that our improved clinical outcomes don't always relate to physical performance and improved physical performance. If we take a picture with that same, we'll go with an ankle. We won't go with the obvious and do shoulder. We'll go with an ankle injury, all right? So this person sprains their ankle, and we, work our butts off, and this is, and we go through a 7 to 10 day, maybe 10 days of rehab, and we start the running progression, we start doing some jogging, we start, we get them going, we get them doing some stop start shuffling, we do all kinds of crazy stuff they're getting better, and we finally get to a point. We may even do a functional test, we may even do a return to play test, because dang it, we are clinicians, and we're going to do our the best job that we can. And so they pass our test, and we go, you're ready to go. I'm going to pat myself on the back, and I did a great job. Go get them, Tiger. At least I call my athletes Tiger. I don't know about you. But when they get out there and they take that step, there's that report. There's that, it doesn't feel right. Feels like it's loose. Feels like this. And you're like, I don't know what to do with that. All right, and you work a little bit more with them. I don't have the power. I can't take that step. And here's the deal. If they do tell you that, well, good for them. And then you have that opportunity. A lot of times they don't tell you. All right. A lot of times they're so focused on the fact that you, the clinician, the expert in healing people, has told them they're good to go. And we've made that decision based on our clinical, our clinical evidence. And I've told you, you are good to go. And that person walks away, especially if they're high school or most college, and they walk away going, I guess I'm good to go. And I have, and I've done all these tests, and so I'm good to go. And so when they do get out there and they can't do what they did before their injury, again, they start to go, all right, is this disablement? Can I overcome this? And they start to figure out a way to accomplish their task. If they're not doing the activity at the exact level they were, maybe they lost their speed. Maybe there's something and they just won't take that big step. They're short striding. And have you ever had this conversation with your coaching staff and go, look, coach, from my end, he's good. Right, from my end, it's y'all. You do what you do on the coaching side, but I can tell you that ankle's ready to go. Right, that ankle may be ready to go, but that person's not ready to go. And there's something going on. There's something that we can do. And because usually what happens if they do change their mechanics, then what happens? We start taking a shorter stride. We're using more upper body. We're using more shoulder. All of a sudden, now we have a shoulder injury. Now this kid's in your clinic with a shoulder injury going, just can't catch a break. First it was my ankle, now it's my arm. I'm cursed. No, not cursed. But we just, I think as athletic trainers, we can probably do a little bit better job capturing some of the different things that are going on and intervene and prevent that shoulder injury. That's kind of our deal. So this is what this whole thing is leading me to, is this patient-reported outcomes measures and let's see what time it is. And actually talking with the patient and seeing what their perception is, what their expectation is, where what they have to do, what they want to do, and so gathering information from them on a personal level. These are just simple, when we talk about patient reported outcome measures, they're just simple patient completed surveys that they rate certain things. There's all different types. There's generic. The generic types are typically the ones that give you a little bit more wider view of that health-related quality of life. And then they have the more specific ones that they focus in on a specific area, like the shoulder or ankle or that kind of stuff. There are a number of reported benefits that patient-reported outcome measures get when you involve them in healthcare. And I've listed a number of them up here. The couple that I want to just highlight real quick is, number one, the communication part, right? Communication, patient communication, interacting with that patient, and getting a lot of the patients said it was a much better way to interact with the clinician from a goal setting, right? When you work with a patient and it's time for rehab and you're filling out your whatever sheet you fill out, do you put goals on there? I mean, do you write down, all right, the goals? And if you do, typically, I'm going to guess, and I'm going to go on a limb here, and say the goals are probably, well, my goal is to reduce swelling, increase range of motion, increase strength, functional activity, all clinician-rated stuff, all right? I don't think if we interact with our patients and go, look, what's going on, and we capture some of this stuff of what they're dealing with and what their expectation is for how they have to live. It may be the first goal is I need to get up and down the stairs. All right, I live on the third floor. Getting up and down stairs is a very important. So that goal setting process was one of the big ones. The other one on the communication side is interacting with other healthcare providers. The other healthcare providers are using patient-reported outcomes. And so as we start to interact with other healthcare providers, and we're talking with, you know, with this terminology, patient-reported outcomes, we look like we're part of the group. You know, we look like we're an allied health profession. So that interaction with other healthcare providers. So a number of professions are using this. Now, it's not 100%. They're not great. And so if you could look into each one of these areas and say, all right, well, how much are these measures really being used? Not going to look at all of them, but I'll pick on physical therapy because athletic training likes to pick on physical therapy. Anywhere between 50 and 70%. All right. Now, granted, this is for the most part, the majority of physical therapists are in a much different setting than the majority of athletic trainers. All right. And so I get that. And so I don't expect us to be into that realm. Yes, they may have more time. They have a lot more insurance issues to deal with. And so insurance companies want proof that the treatments are working and are effective. So yes, you can get some decent numbers. There is, what about athletic trainers? There is one study that's published looked at, does this profession, athletic training, are there patient-reported outcome measures being used in clinical practice? If you haven't looked online, and hopefully most of you haven't, if you haven't looked online, just kind of get a number in your head of how many of the people that they surveyed, what percentage do you think of athletic trainers are using patient-reported outcome measures in their clinical practice? Just kind of think about it. What do you got? 20%. Okay. Well, we'll see. I thought it was going to be really low. When I saw this, when I opened this article, I go, hey, look, we actually did one. That's great. And I looked at this, and I saw this article, and I'm going, oh, this is going to be bad. Okay, here we go. Better than I thought. I looked at that, and I go, 26%. Hey, that's not a bad place to start. But then you read the article. You know, you can read the abstract. You guys just do that, and you look at the abstract part, and go, oh, okay, I'm good. I couldn't do that when I'm doing my lip review for my research, but I look at the abstract, oh, 26%, that's pretty good. As you start reading, the numbers get a little bit more depressing because of that 26% that are using them, half were forced to. They were forced to by their employer. All right, well, that doesn't really make it that much better now. It kind of makes it a little bit worse. So, a couple things, and I wanted to dive into this one. This is the only really research that is done on athletic trainers using patient-reported outcome measures. Couple side notes here. I know this group, Valier, is out of A.T. Still University. I know this group has another follow-up, article that has been approved for publication in the journal, and it'll be out soon. And they've tried to adjust some of the things. And my other side note here is, if you just a suggestion, if you ever want to do an EBP topic, pick one that there's not a lot of research. That's what I do. But all right, so looking into the numbers a little bit more, when you look at the ones now, that 26%, even though they were made to, a lot of them were made to, that 26% using them reported that there's some, you know, the similar benefits that other healthcare providers are reporting by using patient-reported outcomes. And so communication being by far the highest one. When you look at the barriers, the obvious one, and I know all of you right now are sitting here going, I don't have time for this. I ain't got time for that, right? We're so busy, and I get that. Don't worry, I get it, and we'll address that. Time is a major issue. The scoring and interpretation part, yeah, that's a barrier, but that can be overcome pretty easily. That's not a huge deal. For those athletic trainers that were not using them, again, their barriers were primarily time, and then a little bit higher on the fact that I don't know how to do these, so. The actual scoring part, you know, I don't know that, so that would be the barrier. Basically, athletic training has a long way to go before we actually can call ourselves patient-centered. And so, what I want to try to do for the rest of the time is just kind of give you an idea of what we did at Texas Lutheran, and so I got interested in these patient-reported outcome measures, and I went back and said, hey, we should do this. And I have a great rest of the staff at Texas Lutheran, like, okay. Well, what do you want to do? We start talking about this, and it's, you know, there are some challenges, and there are some things that I want you to kind of have an idea. The first thing we did is just we formalized the, hey, how you feel today? Rate your pain. We formalized that a little bit. Just do a simple pain scale, but written down. Instead of just talking to a person, go, hey, how's it feel? 1 to 10, give me a number. Oh, 7, you know. We formalize it a little bit. This year, this is the scale that we're going to use this year. This past year, we used just a simple numeric rating scale where we had a, you know, 1 through 10 type deal. If you're looking for this is, I like this one because it gives you the descriptors underneath there. So it kind of gives some ideas of all right, so now I can kind of qualify. I don't have to come up with, you know, if you put your hand in a vise and I cranked it down, that's it. You know, I don't have to come up with anything, you know, reference on what a 10 is. We at least have some context here to go off of. This is the Wong Baker. Google either way, there you'll find it. And these little faces will come up. We started doing this simple outcome measure. You know, this is a simple pain outcome. All right, we can't see pain. This is not pain. We can't clinically see. Right? If somebody goes, yeah, I have this shooting pain that goes down my leg. It's not like we go, yeah, I can see that going right down. We can't see that. This is their perception, all right? And I know, and we, this is where we get into that conversation. Well, some have good pain tolerance, some have bad pain tolerance. That is true. Never going to stop that, all right? So now, what are we dealing with? What kind of patient are we dealing with when we do stuff? And so we started doing this on a regular basis, at rest, at the time of injury, at the what's the best that it feels during the day, all kinds of different things. We also started using the Global Rating of Change scale. There are a number of global change outcome measures, you know, global change of function, all kinds of stuff. But this was just a simple one question. Hey, since you got hurt and started your treatment, how have you been? Just rate that from start to finish. And so we picked two really quick, easy questions that we can just ask a person, and we had numbers that we could quantify and record outcomes and then track that. This person improved on their pain scale from a 7 down to a 3. That's improvement. We had a person that started at a -2 and now they're at a 6. That's a big improvement. That's a significant change. Yay for us. Or the opposite. Actually, the opposite happened a number of times, which was interesting that we took, you know, and this was, you know, personal patient of mine. Worked with this person, classic ankle, right? Ankle sprain, worked with them, got them back to a point where, hey, you know, we're taping you up and we're functionally testing you, and I think it's, you know, I'm going to give you the clearance to go. Yes. Just real quick, let me get you to fill this out, just circle where you are. And puts down there a somewhat better. And I kind of go, huh, that's interesting that I have cleared you to play physiologically, and you're ready to go play football and go beat yourself up and get beat up and hopefully beat up somebody else more than you get beat up. But you're only somewhat better. I was hoping for a lot more,
Right? I was hoping for a lot better.
And so what that does, all that did, that didn't change the way I practiced. I didn't go, well, hey, maybe you're not going back to practice. I didn't do that. But what I did is I go, okay, what do you still got going? You know, and I had that conversation of, all right, what is still left in your mind that we need to cover? All right, and then it was an educational piece that, all right, you need to keep getting your butt in here, and we will keep working on this. All right, we're not done. Now, we always say that, but how many times do they keep? We get a couple that come in, and they're, you know, our athletic training room junkies that are always there, and our favorite. But the wide majority, you know, once we say go back to play, they're gone until they get hurt again. Right? And a lot of them actually do get hurt again. So the final one that we did, and so this was my thought, we're going to do the pain scale, we're going to do the global rating of change, and then we're going to do this disability in the physically active scale. And all of these are, you know, you can just Google these and you'll find them, you know, in a heartbeat. But this one here, a little bit longer, obviously, 16 questions, still pretty brief. It doesn't take very long for a patient to fill this out. And it gets you a good, if you can look up here, I do have a laser. No laser. But if you look, if you can see it, or if you see it in the slides or look on it, the first part is your typical. There's pain, there's function, and there's all that kind of stuff. And then you kind of get down into some of the more health-related quality of life down toward the end. How does it, on your personal side? And I can tell you from our experience, by far, most of the people that we had fill this out, it was about what you would expect, all right? We're doing a long rehab, and I give this person, they're going to circle, you know, moderate to severe on their pain. And they're, you know, they circle my function. I can't go up and down stairs, so my function. And then they got down to the health-related quality of life, and then it was all the way back over to, nah, no big deal. I'm like, all right, why are we doing this? There were a couple. I'm going to ask this question. This is a rhetorical question. Have you ever had, because I know the answer, have you ever had the situation where there's two very, very similar injuries, if not the same injury, ACL, ACL. Hey, we're buddies. We're going to be rehab buddies. Yay. That's not how we wanted to be buddies. But one of them, after their surgery, about the same time, one of them just takes off and starts just cranking it out, doing real good. The other one struggles. How come he's doing that? Because you're not, you still have a big swollen knee and we can't get your extension back. And that's what, you know, and so that is the kind of stuff. And then we go, well, why? Is it because that person's physiology is different? Do they have a different knee? Do they have a, you know, was their graft compromised? Maybe, but most likely. The chances are there's something else going on. That exact situation happened to TLU. And we had somebody with, when I told you about that football player who lost their identity, starting football player, played football his whole life, started everywhere he's been. And he got hurt. And his starting job goes to somebody else. His social group, his connection, he sees some other clown, which is freshman coming in, and now he's all, you know, chummy, huh? Yeah, that's great. It affected him. He was not, you know, he didn't say that. You know, he still tried to hobble along. Everybody goes, hey, we're going to, you know, practice over. We're going to get some food. Let's go. That's how they walk. No, they just walk off, and what's he doing? He's like, all right, I guess I'll just see you there. You know, and there's not, there that affected him. And he just didn't have the attitude and the zest to get after some of the stuff that he had to get after. So anyway, disability of physically active scale is one of the other ones we use, and I'll kind of give you an idea of what we did. A lot of stuff to kind of go through and figure out, all right, how are we going to fit it in? I put this picture up because I understand the business of an afternoon. I understand there's 100 things going. People are going, hey, what about me? Hey, can I do this? Can I do this? And you're like, sometimes. So I know that's not the time to go, hey, you know what? How about a survey? If you'll just take just a brief moment and fill this out. And oh, let me score it now. Hold on. I'll be right there. No, we're not going to do that. I understand there's some time. Some time edge. But then the bigger ones is like, right, when are we going to do this? What do we do with the information? All right, now that we've collected all this stuff and I got numbers. Yay, I got numbers. What do I do with it? What did I do with it? What did we do with it? We looked at it. We didn't really do much this year. This year was all about, can we fit this in? And we could. And now we can start, you know, kind of, you know, figuring out how we're going to use this stuff. The final thing that before I want to get to just real quick the highlights of what we did is the scoring and the, you know, what to do with the information, what that information means. I put the term psychometrics up there because it's a fancy $10 word and I still owe for that. But that's what you look up. If you're looking at a specific outcome measure and you want to know what the scores mean, you can, you know, if you want to search evidence, you can look at psychometrics. The next two are pretty important. If you get a 48 on the disability of, in the physically active scale, well, is that good or is that bad? Because some are, it doesn't, you know, it's different. Some, a higher score means you're better. Some, like in the DPA, is it's a you know, the higher the score, the more disabled the person is. And then that MCID, the minimal clinically important difference, that's just the one that says, all right, I got to change, but is it significant enough? Does it mean the person's actually better? So I got a 48 the first time I took that DPA. The next time I get a 45. Hey, I got better. Eh, not really. You know, that's not a big enough change to actually to get to that. So that's the other, those are the things that we look at. All right, we want to know how the heck to score it, what does the score mean, and then what is a change? What kind of change are we looking for? If I want to go from a 48 on that outcome measure to a 35, that's a significant change. We know that there's improvement there, that's happened. And so that's the DPA, and you can kind of see some of the reliability and that kind of stuff. Same thing with the global rating of change. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm trying to go quick and not wear you out a little bit. This is what we did. These are the outcome measures that we used. The first one is a kind of a random one. We did for headaches and concussions, we did the HIT-6. It's a simple six-question deal. We did it as a baseline for when we did our screening, all the paperwork. We just gave them this, and they just circled. Idea to get an idea of where your headaches are. You know, are you a chronic migraine or chronic headache person already? And then, you know, what happens after a concussion happens. We really did this mainly to kind of try to get an idea, capture an idea of how bad does the, you know, is there any correlation with how bad their headache is with, you know, if we have to kind of intervene on the academic side. We didn't like just everybody who gets a concussion. We call all the professors and tell them to, hey, give them more time, and, you know, give them some more time on the assignments, and let them take tests later and do all that. Because obviously, you know, newsflash, some people will take advantage of that. So we're trying to figure out that and see if there's anything to that. The numeric rating scale for pain and the GROC, we put those on a sheet, and those are on all of our clipboards. That's the pain scale that we used last year. They've now been updated to have some smiley faces and not so smiley faces. But they're on our clipboard, so when we're doing evaluations, they're right there. We laminated one and we put it in the rehab area. So when we're working with some kiddos, we can go, all right, hey, real quick, look at this and just give me a number, and we can jot that down. Really easy. You know, this stuff is super easy to do. It didn't take up any of our time. When we did the disability and the physically active scale, those are the ones that we knew were going to be long term. All right, so those are our ACL patients, or maybe an MCL, you know, a complete third degree MCL that we know, dude, you're going to be with us for like the next 6 weeks. So we would do it at least at the beginning, you know, within the first couple days of the injury, and then at least at the return to play time, and then depending on how long that was, we might do it a couple times in between. We didn't have a set schedule. We weren't like, ding, it's been 30 days, it's time for you. We didn't do that. We just kind of, you know, as the clinician was working and did that. And then you see at the bottom, I put a bunch of other, you know, fancy names and abbreviations. We did these as we started getting used to this. We started going and started to get some specific ones and you know, on our ankle stuff and because we have a lot of ankle injuries that go, and shoulder injuries and back stuff. So we did those. When you get to those, there's a cool site I wanted to show you. You can write down orthoscores.com is the website. It takes you to this. This is a screenshot of that website. And then what you have is all these different clinician and patient completed outcome measures that you can click on. And let's click on the foot and ankle disability index just because I like saying fatty. Sorry. I'm almost done. I'm getting to the point. But the cool part is you can have them fill it out right there on the computer screen. And so you can print it off, or you can have them do it right on the computer. If you have a tablet, that's what we had. I brought in my tablet and just boom, just, you know, push some buttons. It scores it for you, and you're done. Now I have a score. This, it does not save anything. so it doesn't, there's no, you know, health privacy information that gets logged somewhere. It's just a simple do it on the web page and go. Right? So orthoscores.com, there's all kinds of stuff on there that you can use. And so that's what we did. I can tell you from our experience to this practice-based evidence that we're trying to get to, is this stuff working? I can tell you what we did here for us, it worked. The single question measures were very, you know, easy to work with. The longer rehabs, we did that. I'm not asking or not suggesting that every single patient that comes in with, hey, my arm hurts, I'm not telling them to give them a survey, all right? We're not the doctor's office. But there are some things that I think if we start to, these longer stuff and more involved stuff, we start to act like a healthcare professional and provide some of the patient-centered care, that'll help the profession of athletic training. I know, it's like, is he done yet? Final thing, we did a patient satisfaction survey, mainly, you know, for not just for this, just to evaluate this, but for other stuff. But these questions right here went to our returning patients. You know, the patients that have, they knew us before we started asking them all these questions, and now they knew us afterwards. And we tried to ask, look, did this, you know, do you think this helped? Do you think this hurt? And what was your thought? A little bit different. I think most of them, on that first one, most of them really didn't really care, or a lot of them just like, yeah, I guess it, you know, they were kind of indifferent to it. The one that I really focused on was, hey, how much more time did this take? Do you feel like this took more time out of your life in our clinic? And most of them said no, and so that's that was encouraging. Bottom line, you can see the bottom line, and basically I'll just kind of end here with the fact that I think we need to be aware of the disablement model and the concept of disability, and really the ultimate, you know, outcome of that is patients are different, and the difference between a clinical sign being good and the patient experience is way different. Most of the time, it's going to be about the same. All right, so luckily for us, most of the time it's the same. But there are cases that sometimes when we say you're good to go, the person is, no, I'm not. And what other information can we grasp to help them and not to get to that point? We can do that before they get to that. All right, I do have a lot of, you know, references, and you can look at that on the little handouts deal and look at those if you're interested in them. But thank you.